Greg Bashfulson lodged in a subdivided cellar in Cheap Street. The rent wasn't much, but he had to admit that neither was the accommodation. He could lie on his very narrow bed and touch all four walls, or rather, three walls and a heavy curtain that separated his little space from that of the family of 19 dwarfs that occupied the rest of the cellar. But meals were included, and they respected his privacy. It was something to have a Grag as a lodger, even if this one seemed rather young and showed his face. It was still something to impress the neighbours with. On the other side of the curtain, children were squabbling, a baby was crying, and there was the smell of rattan cabbage casserole. Someone was sharpening an axe, and someone else was snoring. For a dwarf in Ankh-Morpork, solitude was something that you had to cultivate on the inside. Books and papers filled the space that wasn't bed. Bashfulson's desk was a board laid across his knees. He was reading a battered book, its cover cracked and mouldy, and the runes passing under his eye were, "It has no strength in this world. To fulfil any purpose, the dark must find a champion, a living creature it can bend to its will." Bashfulson sighed. He'd read the phrase a dozen times, hoping he could make it mean something other than the obvious. He copied the words into his notebook anyway. Then he put the notebook in his satchel, swung the satchel onto his back, went and paid Toyn Footstamper 2 weeks' rent in advance, and stepped out into the rain. Vimes didn't remember going to sleep. He didn't remember sleeping. He surfaced from darkness when Carrots shook him awake. "The coaches are in the yard, Mr. Vimes." "Where's up?" murmured Vimes, blinking in the light. "I've told people to load them up, sir, but..." "But what?" Vimes sat up. "I think you'd better come and see, sir." Into the damp dawn, two coaches were indeed standing in the yard. Detritus was idly watching the loading while leaning on the peacemaker. Carrot hurried over when he saw the commander. "It's the wizard, sir," he said. "They've done something." The coaches looked normal enough to Vimes, and he said so. "Oh, they look fine," said Carrot. He reached down and put his hand on the door sill, and added, "But they do this." He lifted the laden coach over his head. "You shouldn't be able to do that," said Vimes. "That's right, sir," said Carrot, lowering the coach gently onto the cobbles. "It doesn't get any heavier with people inside it, either. And if you come over here, sir, they've done something to the horses, too." "Any idea what they've done, Captain?" "None whatsoever, sir. The coaches were just outside the university. Haddock and I drove them down here. Very light, of course. It's the harnesses that are worrying me. See here, sir." "I see the leather's very thick," said Vimes. "And what are all these copper knobs? Something magical?" "Could be, sir. Something happens at 13 miles an hour. I don't know what." Carrot patted the side of the coach, which slid away. "The thing is, sir, I don't know how much of an edge this gives you." "What? Surely a weightless coach would..." "Oh, it'll help, sir, especially on the inclines. But horses can only go fast for so long, sir. And once they've got the coach moving, it's a rolling weight and not so much of a problem."
13 miles an hour, Vimes mused.
That's pretty fast." "Well, the mail coaches are making 9 or 10 miles an hour average on many runs now," said Carrot. "But the roads will be a lot worse when you get near Coombe Valley."
"You don't think it'll take wing, do you?"
"I think the wizards would have said so if it was going to do something like that, sir. But it's funny you should mention it, because there's 7 broomsticks nailed underneath each coach."
"What?
Why don't they just float out of the yard?"
"Magic, sir. I think they just compensate for the weight."
Good grief, yes.
"Why didn't I think of that?" said Vimes, sourly. "And that's why I don't like magic, Captain. 'Cause it's magic. You can't ask questions. It's magic. It doesn't explain anything. It's magic. You don't know where it comes from. It's magic. That's what I don't like about magic. It does everything by magic."
"That's the significant factor, sir. There's no doubt about it," said Carrot. "I'll just see to the last of the packing, if you'll excuse me."
Vimes glared at the coaches. He probably shouldn't have brought in the wizards, but where was the choice? Oh, they could probably have sent Sam Vimes all that way in a puff of smoke and the blink of an eye, but who'd actually arrive there, and who'd come back? How would he know if it was him? He was certain that people were not supposed to disappear like that. Sam Vimes had always been, by nature, a pedestrian. That's why he was going to take Willikins as well, who knew how to drive. He'd also demonstrated to Vimes his ability to throw a common fish knife so hard that it was quite difficult to pull out of the wall. At times like this, Vimes liked to see a skill like that in a butler.
"Excuse me, sir," said Detritus behind him. "Could I have a word personal?"
"Yes, of course," said Vimes.
"I hope what I said yesterday in a cell's wasn't going to..."
"Can't remember a word of it," said Vimes. Detritus looked relieved.
"Thank you, sir. I want to take young Brick with us, sir. He's got no kin here, doesn't even know what clan he is. He'll only get messed up again if I take my off of him, and he's never seen the mountains, never been outside the city even."
There was a pleading look in the troll's eyes. Vimes recollected that his marriage to Ruby was happy but childless. "Well, we don't seem to have a weight problem," he said. "All right, but you're to keep an eye on him, okay?" The troll beamed.
"Yes, sir. I'll see you don't regret it, sir."
"Breakfast, Sam," called Sybil from the doorway. Horrible suspicion gripped Vimes, and he hurried over to the other coach where Carrot was strapping on the last bag. "Who packed the food? Did Sybil pack the food?" he said.
"I think so, sir."
"Was there fruit?" said Vimes, probing the horror.
"I believe so, sir. Quite a lot. And vegetables."
"Some bacon, surely?" Vimes was nearly begging. "Very good for a long journey, bacon. It travels well."
"I think it's staying at home today," said Carrot.
"I have to tell you, sir, that Lady Sybil has found out about the bacon sandwich arrangement. She said to tell you that the game was up, sir."
"I am the commander around here, you know," said Vimes, with as much hauteur as he could muster on an empty stomach.
"Yes, sir, but Lady Sybil has a very quiet way of being firm, sir."
"She has, hasn't she?" said Vimes, as they strolled towards the building.
"I'm a very lucky man, you know," he added, just in case Carrot might have got the wrong impression.
"Yes, sir, you are indeed. Captain?"
They turned. Someone was hurrying through the gate. He had two swords strapped to his back.
"Ah, Special Constable Hancock," said Carrot, stepping forward. "Do you have something for me?"
Yes, Captain."
Hancock looked nervously at Vimes.
"This is official business, Andy," said Vimes reassuringly. "Not much to give you, sir, but I asked around, and a young lady sent at least two self-coded droppers to Bionk in the last week. That means it goes to the main tower and gets handed over to whoever turns up with the right authorization. We don't have to know who they are."
"Well done," said Carrot. "Any description?"
"A young lady with short hair is best I could get. Signed the message, A Galas."
Vimes burst out laughing.
"Well, that's about it. Thank you, Special Constable Hancock, very much."
"Crime on the clacks is going to be a growing problem," said Carrot, sadly, when they were alone.
"Quite likely, Captain," said Vimes. "But here and now, we know that our Sally is not being straight with us."
"We can't be certain it's her, sir," said Carrot.
"Oh, no," said Vimes, happily. "This quite cheers me up. It's one of the lesser-known failings of the vampire. No one knows why. It goes with having big windows and easily torn curtains. A sort of undeath wish, you might say. However clever they are, they can't resist thinking that no one will recognise their name if they spell it backwards. Let's go."
Vimes turned to head into the building and noticed a small, neat figure standing patiently by the door. It had the look of someone who was quite happy to wait. He sighed. "I bargain without an axe in my hand, eh?"
"Breakfast, Mr. Bashfulson," he said.
"This is all rather fun," said Sybil an hour later, as the coaches headed out of the city. "Do you remember when we last went on holiday, Sam?"
"That wasn't really a holiday, dear," said Vimes.
Above them, young Sam swung back and forth in a little hammock, cooing.
"Well, it was very interesting all the same," said Sybil. "Yes, dear. Werewolves tried to eat me."
Vimes sat back. The coach was comfortably upholstered and well sprung. At the moment, while it threaded through the traffic, the magical loss of weight was hardly noticeable. Would it mean anything? How fast could a bunch of old dwarfs travel? If they really had taken a big wagon, the coaches would catch them tomorrow, when the mountains were still a distant prospect. In the meantime, at least he could get some rest. He pulled out a battered volume entitled Walking in the Coombe Valley by Eric Wheelbrace, a man who apparently had walked on just about everything bigger than a sheep track in the near Ramtops, and even then had been belabouring mountain goats on apparently sheer cliff faces, and, while pebbles slid and bounced around him, was clearly accusing them of obstructing his right to roam. Eric believed very firmly that the land belonged to the people, and also that he was more the people than anyone else was. Eric went everywhere with a map encased in waterproof material on a string around his neck. Such people are not to be trifled with. It had a sketch map, the only actual map of the valley Vimes had seen. Eric wasn't a half-bad sketch artist. Coombe Valley was... Well, Coombe Valley was basically a drain, that's what it was. Nearly 30 miles of soft limestone rock, edged by mountains of harder rock. So what you had would have been a canyon if it wasn't so wide. One end was almost on the snow line, the other merged into the plains. It was said that even clouds kept away from the desolation that was Coombe Valley. Maybe they did, but that didn't matter. The valley got the water anyway, from meltwater and the hundreds of waterfalls that poured over its walls from the mountains that cupped it. One of those falls, the Tears of the King, was half a mile high. The Coombe River didn't just rise in this valley, it leapt and danced in this valley. By the time it was halfway down, it was a criss-crossing of thundering waters forever merging and parting. They carried and hurled great rocks and played with whole fallen trees from the dripping forests that colonised the scree built up against the walls. They gurgled into holes and rose again, miles away, as fountains. They had no mappable course. A good storm higher up the mountains would bring house-sized rocks and half-a-stricken woodland down in the flood, blocking the sinkholes and piling up dams. Some of these could survive for years, becoming little islands in the leaping waters, growing little forests and little meadows, and colonies of big birds. Then some key rock would be shifted by a random river, and within an hour it would all be gone. Nothing that couldn't fly lived in the valley, at least for long. The dwarfs had tried to tame it back before the first battle. It hadn't worked. Hundreds of dwarfs and trolls had been swept up in the famous flood, and many had never been found again. Coombe Valley had taken them all into its sinkholes and chambers and caverns, and had kept them. There were places in the valley where a man could drop a coloured cork into a swirling sinkhole, and then wait for more than 20 minutes before it bobbed up on a fountain less than a dozen yards away. Eric himself had seen this trick done by a guide, Vimes read, who demanded $0.50 for the demonstration. Oh yes, people visited the valley, human sightseers, poets, and artists looking for inspiration in the rugged, uncompromising wildness. And there were human guides who would take them up there for a hefty price. For a few extra dollars they'd tell the history of the place. They'd tell you how the wind in the rocks and the roaring of the waters carried the sounds of ancient battle, continuing in death. They'd say, maybe all those trolls and dwarfs the valley took are still fighting, down there in the dark maze of caves and thundering torrents. One admitted to Eric that, when he was a boy and during a cool summer when the meltwaters were pretty low, he'd roped down into one of the sinkholes, because, like all such stories, the history of Coombe Valley wouldn't have been complete without rumours of vast treasures swept down into the dark, and had himself heard, above the sound of the water, battle noises and the shouting of dwarfs. No, sir, honestly, sir, it chilled my blood, so it did, sir. Why, thank you very much, sir. Vimes sat up in his seat. Was that true? If that man had gone a little further, would he have found the little talking cube that Methodia Rascal had been unlucky enough to take home? Eric had dismissed it as an attempt to scrounge another dollar, and probably it was, but... No, the cube would surely have been long gone by then. Even so, it was an intriguing thought. The driver's hatch slid back.
"Outside the city, sir. Clear road ahead," Willikins reported.
"Thank you." Vimes stretched and looked across at Sybil. "Well, this is where we find out. Hang on to young Sam."
"I'm sure Mustrom wouldn't do anything dangerous, Sam," said Sybil.
"I don't know about that," said Vimes, opening the door. "I'm sure he wouldn't mean to." He swung himself out and hauled himself onto the roof of the coach with a helping hand from Detritus. The coach was moving well. The sun was shining. On either side of the highway, the cabbage fields lent their gentle perfume to the air. Vimes settled down beside the butler.
"Okay," he said. "Everyone holding on to something? Good. Let 'em go."
Willikins cracked the whip. There was a mild jolt as the horses stretched, and Vimes felt the coach speed up. And that seemed to be it. He'd expected something a little more impressive. They were gradually going faster, yes, but that in itself didn't seem very magical.
"I reckon about 12 miles an hour now, sir," said Willikins. "That's pretty good. They're running well without—"
Something was happening to the harnesses. The copper discs were sparking.
"Look at the cabbages, sir!"
Detritus shouted. On either side of the road, cabbages were bursting into flame and rocketing out of the ground, and still the horses went faster.
"'It's about power!' yelled Vimes above the wind. "'We're running on cabbages! And a—'
He stopped. The rear two horses were rising gently in the air. As he stared, the lead pair rose too. He risked turning in his seat. The other coach was keeping up with them. He could clearly see Fred Colon's pink face staring in rigid terror. When Vimes turned back to look ahead, all four horses were off the ground. And there was a fifth horse, larger than the other four, and transparent. It was visible only because of the dust and the occasional glint of light off an invisible flank. It was, in fact, what you got if you took away a horse, but left the movement of a horse, the speed of a horse, the spirit of a horse, that part of a horse which came alive in the rushing of the wind, the part of a horse that was, in fact, horse. There was hardly any sound now. Perhaps sound was unable to keep up.
"Sir," said Willikins quietly.
"Yes,"
said Vimes, his eyes streaming.
"It took us less than a minute to go that last mile. I timed us between milestones, sir."
60 miles an hour? Don't be daft, man. A coach can't go that fast."
"Just as you say, sir."
A milestone flashed past. Out of the corner of his ear, Willikins heard Vimes counting under his breath until, before very long, another stone fell away behind them.
"Wizards, eh?" said Vimes weakly, staring ahead again.
"Indeed, sir," said Willikins. "May I suggest that once we are through Quirm, we head straight across the grass country?"
"The roads up there are pretty bad, you know," said Vimes.
"So I believe, sir. However, that will not, in fact, matter," said the butler, not taking his eyes off the unrolling road ahead.
"Why not? If we try to go at speed over those rough—"
"I was referring obliquely, sir, to the fact that we are not precisely touching the ground any more."
Vimes, clinging with care to the rail, looked over the side. The wheels were turning idly. The road just below them was a blur. Ahead of them, the spirit of the horse galloped serenely onwards.
"There's plenty of coaching inns around Quirm," he said. "We could, stop for lunch?"
"A late breakfast, sir. Mail coach ahead, sir. Hold tight."
A tiny square block on the road ahead was getting bigger quite fast. Willikins twitched the reins, Vimes had a momentary vision of rearing horses, and the mail coach was a dwindling dot, soon hidden by the smoke of flaming brassicas.
"Dem milestones, he's going past real fast now,"
Detritus observed, in a conversational tone of voice. Behind him, Brick lay flat on the roof of the coach with his eyes tight shut, having never before been in a world where the sky went all the way to the ground. There were brass rails around the top of the coach, and he was leaving fingerprints in them.
"Could we try braking?" said Vimes. "Look out, hay cart!"
"That only stops the wheels spinning, sir," yelled Willikins as the cart went by with a whoom and fell back into the distance.
"Try pulling on the reins a little."
"At this speed, sir."
Vimes slid back the hatch behind him. Sybil had young Sam on her knee and was pulling a woolly jumper over his head.
"Is everything all right, dear?" he ventured.
She looked up and smiled.
"Lovely smooth ride, Sam. Aren't we going rather fast, though?"
"Could you please sit with your back to the horses," said Sam, "and hold on tight to young Sam? It might be a bit bumpy."
He watched her shift seats. Then he shut the hatch and yelled to Willikins,
"Now!"
Nothing seemed to happen. In Vimes's mind, the milestones were already going zip, zip as they flashed past. Then the flying world slowed, while in the fields on either side hundreds of burning cabbages leapt towards the sky, trailing oily smoke. The horse of light and air disappeared, and the real horses dropped gently towards the road, going from floating statues to beasts in full gallop without a stumble. He heard a brief scream as the rear coach tore past and swerved into a field full of cauliflowers, where eventually it squelched to a flatulent halt. And then there was stillness, except for the occasional thud of a falling cabbage. Detritus was comforting Brick, who'd not picked a good day to go cold turkey. It was turning out to be frozen rock. A skylark, safely above cabbage range, sang in the blue sky. Below, except for the whimpering of Brick, all was silent. Absent-mindedly, Vimes pulled a half-cooked leaf off his helmet and flicked it away.
"Well, that was fun," he said, his voice a little distant.
He got down carefully and opened the coach door.
"Everyone all right in here?" he said.
"Yes, why have we stopped?" said Sybil.
"We ran out of, well, we just ran out," said Vimes. "I better go and check that everyone else is all right."
The milestone nearby proclaimed that it was but 2 miles to Quirm.
Vimes fished out the gooseberry as a red-hot cabbage smacked into the road behind him.
"Good morning," he said brightly to the surprised imp. "What is the time, please?"
9 minutes to 8,
insert name here," said the imp. "So that would mean a speed slightly above 1 mile a minute," mused Vimes. "Very good."
Moving like a sleepwalker, he went into the field on the other side of the road and followed the trail of stricken, steaming greens until he reached the other coach. People were climbing out of it.
"Everyone okay?" he said. "Breakfast today will be boiled cabbage, baked cabbage, fried cabbage."
He stepped smartly aside as the steaming cauliflower hit the ground and exploded.
"And cauliflower surprise. Where's Fred?"
"Looking for somewhere to throw up," said Angua.
"Good man. We'll take a minute or two to rest here, I think."
With that, Sam Vimes walked back to the milestone, sat down next to it, put his arms around it, and held on tight until he felt better. You could catch up with the dwarfs long before they're near Coombe Valley. Good grief, at the speed we did earlier, you'd have to watch out in case you smashed into the back of them. Vimes's thought nagged at him as Willikins drove the coach at a very sedate speed out of Quirm and then, on a clear stretch of road, unleashed the hidden horsepower until he were bowling along at 40 miles every hour. That seemed quite fast enough. No one was hurt, after all. You could get to Coombe Valley by nightfall. Yes, but that was not the plan. Okay, he thought, but what is the plan exactly? Well, it helped that Sybil knew more or less everybody, at least everybody who was female, of a certain age, and who had been to the Quirm College for Young Ladies at the same time as Sybil. There appeared to be hundreds of them. They all seemed to have names like Bunny or Bubbles. They kept in touch meticulously. They'd all married influential or powerful men. They all hugged one another when they met, and went on about the good old days in Form 3B or whatever. And if they acted together, they would probably run the world, or, it occurred to Vimes, might already be doing so. They were ladies who organize. Vimes did his best, but he could never keep track of them. A web of correspondence held them all together, and he marvelled at Sybil's ability to be concerned over the problems of a child which she'd never met, of a woman she hadn't seen for 25 years. It was a female thing. So they would be staying in the town near the foot of the valley with a lady currently known to him only as Bunty, whose husband was his local magistrate. According to Sybil, he had his own police force. Vimes translated this in the privacy of his head as, "He's got his own gang of thuggish, toothless, evil-smelling thief-takers," since that was what you generally got in these little towns. Still, they might be useful. Beyond that, there was no plan. He intended to find the dwarfs and capture and drag as many as possible back to Ankh Morpork. That was an intention, not a plan. It was a firm intention, though. 5 people had been murdered. You couldn't just turn your back on that. He'd drag them back and lock them up and throw everything at them and see what stuck. He doubted if they had many friends now. Of course it'd get political, it always did, but at least people would know that he'd done all he could, and it was the best he could do. And with any luck, it would stop anyone else getting his funny ideas. And then there was the damned secret. But it occurred to him that if he did find it, and it simply was proof that the dwarfs ambushed the trolls, or the trolls ambushed the dwarfs, or they both ambushed each other at the same time, well, he might as well drop it down a hole. It wouldn't change anything. And it was unlikely to be a pot of gold. People didn't take a lot of money on battlefields, because there wasn't very much to spend it on. Anyway, it had been a good start. They'd clawed some time, hadn't they? They could keep a cracking pace and change horses at every staging in, couldn't they? Why was he trying to persuade himself? It made sense to slow down. It was dangerous to go fast.
"If we keep up this pace, we might get there the day after tomorrow, right?" he said to Willikins as they rattled on between the stands of young maize.
"If you say so, sir," said Willikins. Vimes noted the hint of diplomacy.
"You don't think so?" he said. "Come on, you can speak your mind."
"Well, sir, those dwarfs want to get there fast, do you think?" said Willikins.
"I expect so. I don't think they want to hang around, so."
"So, I'm just puzzled that you think they'll be using the roads, sir. They could use broomsticks, couldn't they?"
"I suppose so," Vimes conceded. "But the Arch-Chancellor would have told me if they'd done that, surely."
"Begging your pardon, sir, but what business would it be of his? They wouldn't have to bother the gentlemen at the university. Everyone knows the best broomsticks are made by the dwarfs up at Copperhead."
The coach rolled on.
After a while, Vimes observed, in the voice of one who has been thinking deeply, "They'd have to travel at night, though. They'd be spotted otherwise."
"Very true, sir," said Willikins, staring ahead.
There was more thoughtful silence.
"Do you think this thing could jump fences?" said Vimes.
"I'm game to give it a try, sir," said Willikins. "I think the wizard's put some thought into all this."
"And how fast do you think it could go, for the sake of argument?" said Vimes.
"Don't know, sir, but I've got a feeling it might be pretty fast. 100 miles an hour, maybe?
You really think so? That means we could be halfway there in a couple of hours."
"Well, you did say you wanted to get there fast, sir," said Willikins.
This time the silence went on longer before Vimes said, "All right, stop somewhere. I want to make sure that everyone knows what we're going to do."
"Happy to do that, sir," said Willikins. "It'll give me a chance to tie my hat on."